we'd probably all agree that the place of sexuality in American life has changed over the past 350 years. Estelle Friedman is a historian who wanted to know how those sexual changes correlate to cultural and political change in American history. Although today we have Dr. Ruth, Playboy, and clues to our sexuality almost everywhere we look, in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, the subject was much more private. To learn about the sexuality of those earlier times, Friedman went to court records on sexual crimes, diaries, letters, and reform tracts written by moralists who tried to describe sexual habits. Estelle Friedman is the co-author, with John D'Amelio, of the new book Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. She's an associate professor of history at Stanford University. I spoke with her from station KQED in San Francisco, and I asked her why she was interested in sexual history.
Well, I think there are two answers to that, and they both are somewhat personally historic. That is, I was becoming a professional historian in the early 1970s at a time when I think American youth, American society in general, was beginning to develop a new sexual politics, as the feminist movement called it, and all around me were questions of abortion, women's liberation, gay liberation, questions that I think made it into the national political agenda in the 70s and 80s, that for a young student of history raised questions about how did we get here? Mm-hmm. Why is this so important to us now? And more historically, in terms of the discipline and the profession, I was training at a time when the new social history, as it was called, became dominant in the field of historical studies, shifting our attention from political, public events such as war, diplomacy, the presidency, to personal life, to family life, the history of women, health, childhood. And I suppose that once you start studying the private side of history, ultimately you're going to get to the most private of all, which in our society has sometimes been sexuality.
Do you think that you learn something different about sexuality looking at historically than, than you would if you were looking at it, say, morally?
Oh, definitely. Or psychologically or sociologically,
yeah.
Although they're related.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that bringing historical perspective, it rests on an idea that sexuality is historically and socially constructed, that it is not God-given, and that gets us away from the moralism a little bit. It is not static. It is not something just essential and intrinsic to each individual or something that we're all born with, but that historical factors shape the possibilities for sexuality in any era. And that opens up a question of change over time. How have the meanings and practices and ideas about sexuality changed over time? And that's very different. The moralist approach is somewhat more static, more judgmental. And I think that in working on the history of sexuality, you really have to let go of judgment and let go of contemporary notions of even what sex is, to look back and say, what did sexuality mean in the past? How did it differ? How did the meaning change over time? And then the question is, why?
Mm-hmm.
What economic, what demographic, what political factors reshaped the meaning of sexuality over the course of American history? And that's really what the book Intimate Matters is about, how that reshaping took place.
Well, before we get into some of the historic details of your study, I'm going to ask you a couple of big picture type questions.
Sure.
What are some of the preconceptions that you think your study challenges, the preconceptions that we might have about sexuality and how it's changed?
Well, I think that the key preconception that we try to challenge is that somehow the story of the history of sexuality is a triumphant one, moving from repression to liberation, that we go from these Puritans or repressed Victorians to the liberated moderns. And we clearly challenge that notion at the outset and suggest that historians have known for a long time none of those stereotypes hold. And we actually want to change the question away from focusing on repression and liberation and suggest that those are not the interesting questions. That's really a false notion of historical change in terms of sex. If anything, the question we ask is, why has sex become so important in the modern period, not has it become better or freer? I think that's the main challenge that we undertook in trying to break away from past approaches.
Well, you're saying you're trying to look at why has sex become so important? Is that the way you put it?
Yes. In other words, the story is not so much has sex gotten better, more liberated, more free in some progressive way, but rather, why have we become so obsessed about whether sex is good or not?
Mm-hmm.
Why has it become a key feature of individual identity and a major battleground in national politics, really. This was not necessarily the case 200 years ago, even 150 years ago. And gradually, I think over the last century, sex has become critical as a component of personal identity and increasingly a part of a national political conflict that we've seen particularly in the last generation.
That takes us back to a question you asked a couple of minutes ago, which is your investigation into what sex is and what does it mean to the people who are engaged in it. So let's go back a couple of hundred years. Your study really starts during the time of the colonies in America, at a time when you say sex was seen as, you know, pretty much just a reproductive function within a marital setting.
Right, which is not to say it wasn't pleasurable. In fact, there was not a conflict between those qualities of sort of the duty to procreate and individual pleasure. There was even a scientific, if you will, notion that one had to have pleasure, both man and woman, in order to conceive. So you have a nice congruence of pleasure and duty. And the primary meaning, as you say, of sexuality in that early period in the 17th, 18th century was familial reproduction. Sex might occur during courtship, but you'd better get married if you get pregnant. And indeed, the sort of small homogeneous communities of that period could usually enforce marriage in the case of pregnancy.
Would it be fair to look at the past? And I know you said that you don't really like to see sexual history in terms of liberation versus mm-hmm. repression. Yet, I think that your study really shows that there are so many predecessors in those battles, in the mm-hmm. current battle between repression and liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Can we look back at some of those predecessors?
Oh, yes, and we do. And I think that I would have to admit we're very delighted to find some of the stories of sexual radicals in the 19th century, for example. But again, to try to move it into a different way of looking at things, you can say, why did a free love movement appear in the 19th century? Why did the battles between the forces for free love, these kind of marginal radicals who argued not for promiscuity by any means, but that love should be free of the control of the state or of the church, that sex should only occur in loving relationships, not necessarily those sanctioned by marriage. Why did this appear in the 19th century, and why did it evoke such strong condemnation and criticism at the time, including very strong repressive measures by the likes of anti-obscenity reformer Anthony Comstock, who mm-hmm. really brought the wrath of the government down and imprisoned these free lovers in the late 19th century.
Rather
than looking at them just as heroes and heroines who mm-hmm. Called for a new idea of sexuality, we tend to ask, how did those ideas about free love reflect larger changes taking place in which sex had moved from this reproductive meaning to a more spiritualized meaning, a sense of intimacy, a way of bringing couples together? And in that case, the free lovers become essentially the logical extension of the dominant new meaning of sexuality. Yes, they were the extreme, but they also reflected tendencies towards romanticized, spiritualized sex that was, in a sense, infiltrating American middle-class family values about sex, not just reproduction, but intimacy, love, passion, and holding the marriage together. So that they're not just radicals. They really are coming out of a movement throughout the society. Why do they have such a strong effect, such a strong reaction against them? Well, because they were the extreme, because they were the logical extreme of a movement that frightened many people who wanted to go back to a reproductive system. And thus you get the severe repression, I think.
My guest is Estelle Friedman, and she's the co-author of the new book, Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. Let's talk about some of the regulations that there have been over time of sexuality. Recently we've seen some court cases in which sodomy laws that have been on the books that haven't really been used for years, really archaic laws, have been used again.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back a couple hundred years again. When the sex laws were actually on the books and when the legislature was one of the main characters in the control of sexuality, were these laws really enforced?
Yes and no. That is, you have sodomy laws, for example, as early as the 17th and 18th century, and indeed they were occasionally enforced, although not always to the full extent. It was a capital offense in many of the colonies, and there are occasions of execution for sodomy in the 17th and 18th century. There are also cases where, for example, a wealthy man generally respected in the community is not going to be executed, but fined or temporarily banished and then forgiven. So that there was always an uneven enforcement of some of these laws. And in the 19th century, the sodomy laws, as well as many other laws about morality, about sexuality, declined in terms of enforcement. State legislatures were more interested in economic growth and in regulating the economy ultimately. And this concern about the state and morality, I think, reappears in the 20th century at a time when sexual values had changed so greatly that there's a new crackdown on the boundaries, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about this in the 20th century not so much in terms of a sexual revolution, but as something we call sexual liberalism that dominates in the first half or more of the 20th century, when the meaning of sexuality has really separated from reproduction to the extent that individual happiness is defined as sexual pleasure, presumably in marriage or on the way to marriage. But the boundaries around that become tightened so that acts such as sodomy or homosexuality as a practice are more threatening as sort of the acts within marriage and youth sexuality are loosened up and there's more acceptance of them. And so within the system, which looks to some like a sexual revolution, there are tightening of enforcement around the boundaries, and homosexuality is a good example. Not just the sodomy laws, but for example, in the post-World War II period, the government began firing homosexuals from the civil service, from the military, real sort of witch hunts to enforce this boundary at the very time that you're getting a rise in sexually explicit materials in magazines and in movies. And you can sort of see this opening up to certain sexual ideas and practices while you maintain the boundaries by enforcing in other areas.
Let's get back to regulation for a second. Your book is in part a history of who has tried to regulate sex.
That's true, yeah.
There's the church, there's the legislature, but then doctors enter the act, and there's a period when women themselves are considered to be the main regulators of sexuality. Can we talk briefly, first, about doctors? How did they, and in what way, were they expected to become, or did they become, regulators of sexuality?
I don't think they were expected to, but I think that with the emergence of a strong medical profession in the late 19th century, one of the ways that doctors upped their status, as it were able to get more public authority was through claiming authority over sexuality. In an earlier period, it had been the clergy who moralized about sexuality. Then there was a period in which there was really almost a vacuum of church and state interest in which women had been more interested in and powerful in regulating sexuality in the community level. But around the 1850s, 60s, when the American Medical Association had recently formed and began to lobby state legislatures, they really used issues such as abortion mm-hmm. as ways of claiming authority for doctors. As we point out, and as historians have known for some time, the criminalization of abortion in the late 19th century was led by the AMA, by the medical profession, not by religious leaders, not by clergy, not by women, but by doctors who really were trying to medicalize the problem. Previously, a woman could decide if a fetus had, quote, quickened or not. And if it hadn't, if it was before she claimed there was life, the abortion was not necessarily illegal or immoral. And it was really doctors who led the campaign to move control over abortion from the woman to the medical expert. So there's an example, I think most historians would agree, of doctors who had a very low status in the early 19th century, who didn't really know how to cure disease until germ theory in the late 19th century. At the same time that they're trying to upgrade their reputations as healers, they move out to become public authorities over issues that they claim as public health issues. And it's really, I think, in the late 19th and early 20th century that the medical profession reaches this heyday in terms of sexual regulation. And in the early to mid-20th century, the psychiatric profession joins in that process.
Let me ask you briefly about women as regulators. When was it expected that women would be the regulators of sexuality, and what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, you could say that both men and women had an important role in the community regulation of morality in traditional small colonial towns. In the 19th century, with the movement of men largely into the public sphere with industrialization and commerce, women in the home become very important as mothers, teaching their children sexual morality, teaching girls to be chaste and boys to contain their lusts. And they also, by the 1820s and 1830s, are organizing mothers' committees and moral reform organizations to oppose prostitution, to oppose male seduction. And they keep those organizations going in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, lead a social purity movement for a single standard of morality in the late 19th century. And then I think their power begins to dissipate somewhat in the 20th century, of sort of organized middle-class white womanhood.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you about birth control and about other changes in sexuality, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Estelle Friedman. She's the co-author of the new book, Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about a history of sexuality in America with my guest, Estelle Friedman, co-author of the book, Intimate Matters. You know, in a way, I guess before there was reliable birth control, the only way a woman had to really control reproduction was to control her husband, to control their sexual desires.
Yes, and there was actually a term for that method called voluntary motherhood, or a woman's right to say no to her husband.
Mm-hmm. Now, once there is birth control, is that the turning point to you about when our definitions of sex start to change, when the role of sex in people's personal lives starts to change, when it starts to get cut off, when it's not completely associated with reproduction, when people start doing it more with a sense of personal expression, personal fulfillment? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's some truth to that, but I might turn the causality around a little bit and suggest that we get birth control mm-hmm. because sexuality and reproduction are being separated. And what I mean by that is that the family was beginning to reduce its size with the coming of cities, commerce, industrialization by the early 19th century. And couples begin looking for ways to do that, whether they do it by continence or abstinence or early forms of contraception. It's really in the early 20th century that you get a birth control movement led by Margaret Sanger and later new technologies, so that I think, in a sense, you had people in search of birth control before you had the public acceptance of it. And yes, the change in sexuality is very related to the separation of it from reproduction, and birth control enhances that. But as I say, it's not the cause. It is an effect of these larger changes in the desired family size, and then the meaning of sex within marriage when you're no longer having as many children as possible, say, in an agricultural society.
But birth control is one of the conditions that did contribute to a more open sexuality.
If you look at both the entry of women into the paid labor force and contraception together, it mm-hmm. goes a long way towards explaining why an old familial reproductive sexual system is never really possible again with contraceptive technology and women's work. So that sexuality moves away from its reproductive moorings. And the other element that one has to bring in here and that we emphasize in the book is that sexuality is being drawn outside of the home into the public sphere of commerce increasingly. And I think that's the other part of this formula of birth control, women's work, and the commercialization of sexuality.
And by commercialization, you mean sex in advertising, sex in TV, sex in the movies, sex in lyrics of songs, that sex is just much more public.
Very public, and also that it's tied to products. Both it's used to sell all kinds of products in a consumer-oriented society in the 20th century, and it becomes a commodity itself. Originally an illegitimate one, prostitution, but increasingly a sexual service industry or a sexual service sector of the economy develops from nightclubs and cabarets to Playboy clubs to male strippers to pornography, sex is a big industry in America today.
So with your view of history, you think that there's really no turning back to the days when sexual relations were seen as procreative, purely procreative, and an act only to be had within marital relationship. You think because of women's changing role in society, because of contraception, because of the commercialization of sex, that there's no turning back?
Yes, I think that's a fairly accurate description of our conclusions, that we can never go back to what we had before, which is not a prediction of what will come in the future. It's very hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
But that, yeah, those three elements, particularly commercialization, birth control, and women's work outside of the home, have changed the meaning of sexuality irrevocably.
Now, in some ways, I think the AIDS epidemic is being used as a way to regain social control over sex by those forces in society who would like to regulate sex.
Yeah, I think there has been such an effort. You're right. I don't know that it can be successful because of those underlying historic changes we've just discussed, and because there's another element to the response to AIDS, which is to try to, in the face of such an enormous health crisis, open discussion of sexuality to a greater extent than in the past, so that the remaining taboos, the remaining discomforts about talking about sex in public may have to fall in a way that would undermine that effort to return to an earlier kind of moralism. So there's counter tendencies going on in response to AIDS, I think.
There are so many more gays and lesbians who are out now than I think mm-hmm. we've ever experienced before. How do you think the gay liberation movement mm-hmm. has affected the way the heterosexual sexual climate?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, do you think that there are things that heterosexuals have learned about sexuality, about male and female sexuality, through witnessing the gay liberation movement?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't know exactly how to answer it. I would say that certainly in the 1970s, a sort of gay male ethic of sex as pleasure and sort of taking the commercialization of sex in some ways to an extreme may have begun to filter out of just the gay community to perhaps it was just coincident with the sort of swinging singles heterosexual scene. So I don't know if it's so much influenced or if they're both part of the same pattern. And today in the 80s, I guess one could argue that the response to AIDS that the gay community has pioneered in some ways in this other trend that I was just mentioning about an openness about sex and safe sex and sexual health out of necessity that I think is coming more slowly to the heterosexual population, but nonetheless I think is becoming more important. I don't really have a good answer to that. It's almost a contemporary sociological question that I haven't thought about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that it reminds me, though, of some other kind of patterning that I'd like to go back to that's not quite as clear in the present, but in general, and that is the way that racial minorities have, in some periods, the early part of the 20th century, for example, been seen by the dominant white middle class as somehow sexual pioneers. And I'm thinking of the change in sexual morality, say, in the teens and the 20s, and the way that white youth began to emulate, say, the dancing and the sexual openness of some immigrant and black migrant youth cultures. And I don't know if you could draw a parallel between that period and what's happened, say, in the 70s and 80s in terms of the gay and lesbian sexual culture being something that other groups might emulate. But that's the kind of historical question I might want to think about, whether there's some parallels there. Certainly, I think the politicization of sex by feminism and gay liberation has been a model for both mainstream American society and certainly for the right, mm-hmm. which politicized in many ways in response to a feminist and gay left politicization of sex, a call for an extension of sexual liberalism to women and to homosexuals, and then you get, in response to that, this call to move back to a reproductive familial system from the new right and the moral majority.
Is studying sexuality in a historical context accepted in academia?
Increasingly so. When we started graduate school in the early 70s, I think each of us would have laughed at the notion of doing a history of sexuality. And by the time we had finished our training in the mid to late 1970s, we had begun to accept it, even if the old guard had not. By now, the late 1980s, we've been able to write a book based on really 10 or 15 years of research that has increasingly become respected. And at least thus far, the work that we've done seems to be considered quite legitimate.
Now that you've completed your history of sexuality in America, what are the next questions that you think sexual history should investigate?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're really looking forward to seeing how people respond. We tried to do an overview and a synthesis that would open up new questions. And I can say personally what I would like to do, and that is to look more closely at the history of sexual violence and particularly of rape. It was one of the questions that most intrigued me in working on this book. It was a key means of maintaining racial dominance in the 19th and 20th century, and it is one that is very central to a feminist analysis, has made feminist theory, has made rape a really central issue in the modern period. And I'd like to go back historically and see how the law, medicine, media have changed in their treatment of rape throughout our history. That's the next big question that I'd like to work on.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your current research. My guest has been Estelle Friedman. She's the co-author of the new book, Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. It's published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.